Your Majesties, Your Royal Highness, Excellencies, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honor and pleasure for me to be here to speak in this magnificent environment. I can tell you, Singapore is nothing as old as this, so it's a real pleasure to be here. My goal here today is to try to add value to you, and sadly, the only way I can add value to you is to tell you about a major collision that is about to happen. Right now, I mean, if I describe the theme of my remarks, I would say the theme would be Chronicles of a Tragedy Foretold. Because you can see right now, you open the newspapers every day, the United States and China, like two cars racing towards each other, going directly at each other, and obviously moving to some major collision. And if that collision happens, as it is likely to, sadly, not just the United States and China will be damaged, all of us, the rest of the world. Netherlands will be affected, the European Union will be affected, I can assure you Singapore will be affected, ASEAN, Southeast Asia will be affected. So all of us, frankly, have a stake in what's going to happen between the United States and China, and I hope that we can, at some point in time, especially Europe and Southeast Asia, work together to see what we can do to prevent such a major collision from happening. But to prevent it from happening, you first have to understand what are the driving forces. What's actually driving these two major powers towards a collision? And it'd be great if we had a simple story to tell. Unfortunately, it's a very, very complex story. And what I'll try to do today is to bring out some of that complexity in the hope that if we understand it better, maybe we can then work together to see what we can do to prevent this collision from happening. And to explain the complexity, I'm going to begin by saying there's just not one dimension in the struggle between the United States and China. There are at least five dimensions, and each of these dimensions have got their own complexity. And I've got to bring all that out in 25 minutes or less. So let me begin. And let me tell you very quickly what the five dimensions are. So first is economic, two is political, third is military, fourth is cultural, and fifth is what I call primacy. Now let's start with the economic dimension. Now as you all know, and Hank mentioned, the trade war has broken up, right? So the simple question, let's ask ourselves a very simple question. Who's right, who's wrong in this dispute? Now, of course, if you talk, as I did, last year I was on sabbatical, I went to Harvard, I spoke to the leading trade economist in Harvard, and he says, Donald Trump's views on international trade are just rubbish, right? Exports are good. Imports are bad. Now, how do you get exports if you don't have imports? And he said if you give Donald Trump a 101, economics 101 paper on international trade, he would fail. He doesn't understand, you know, the theory of comparative advantage, doesn't understand how international trade works. And so you would assume that because he got this thing completely wrong, everybody would be against Donald Trump on trade. But guess what? Donald Trump is opposed ferociously on most of the things he does, and the United States today is probably as more polarized than it's ever been in a long time. The Democrats attack him every day, except on one issue, when he attacks China. And that's the only issue on which Donald Trump gets bipartisan support. So how is it somebody can completely misunderstand international trade and get complete support from the most sophisticated society on planet Earth. What's going on here? That's where the complexity comes in. For a start, I would say, if you want to do a fair analysis, it's clear that China has made serious strategic mistakes in its handling of its trade relationship with the United States. As you know, there are allegations by American businesses of their intellectual property being stolen or being forced to share technology, of unfair competition. And at the end of the day, it's clear that the big strategic mistake that China made was to alienate one of the most important constituencies in the United States of America, which is the business community. And in the past, the business community would always try to put a brick whenever anyone tried to attack China. This time, they let it go. So it's flying. And you can see, as you know, when you start a dispute, it spirals and it's very hard to stop. And Hank mentioned, and I agreed, that until about 2-3 weeks ago, I too was reasonably optimistic that, hey, at the end of the day, in trade, you can get a win-win deal. You get something, I get something, we can make a deal. And I was actually optimistic that when Xi Jinping and Donald Trump meet in, I think in Japan at the end of June, some kind of deal would happen. That was just 2-3 weeks ago. Now it seems less and less likely. So what's gone wrong? The problem here is, to find out whether or not a deal will happen, it will depend on what your objectives are. If the goal of the Trump administration is to reduce the trade deficit, as you know, United States got a deficit over $400 billion with China, then you can meet that goal. You can find a way of reducing the trade deficit. The Chinese will buy more soybean, more Boeing jets, shale oil. You can reduce the trade deficit. But the question is that the goal of the Trump administration? So what's becoming clearer is that the people who are making this policy on US-China trade relations, while they declare that their objective is reduction of the trade deficit, their real objective is something more fundamental. They want to decouple the US and Chinese economies because they believe that the only reason why China has succeeded for so long is because it's enjoyed free access to the American market. So if you can cut China out, China is going to collapse and it won't succeed. So the question is, what is the real objective of the Trump administration? And if any one of you knows the real answer, please let me know, because I'm curious to find out too. And that may explain, recently you saw the news reports, beware of news reports, that said that the Chinese had come back and deleted phrases from the agreement that were agreed to, so the Chinese had backtracked. Now, let me give you an example of what the Chinese deleted. And this was fortunately revealed by Kevin Rudd, the former Australian Prime Minister who speaks Mandarin fluently, knows China very well. He said, just a couple of days ago, he said, the Americans put in the agreement, right, that if the China violates the agreement, United States can retaliate. Fair enough, United States can retaliate. But they added in the agreement, if United States retaliates, China cannot counter-retaliate. Now that, as Kevin Rudd said, even as Prime Minister of Australia, he couldn't accept it. How can you ask the Chinese to accept it? So whoever put this phrase in was obviously putting in a poison pill that would ensure that there's no agreement. So then that makes it more difficult. What is the game being played on the economic front? Now let me go to the political front. Now, at least on the economic front, you can think of win-win games. In the political front, it's a bit harder. It's two opposite sides. Because on one side, you have the United States that believe that there is only one legitimate form of government, which is democracy. And at the end of the day, the United States can only work and trust fellow democracies. And as you know, China, in case you didn't know this, is not a democracy. And it's not going to become a democracy anytime soon. But the United States, many people in the United States, genuinely believed that with a through a process of engagement between the United States and China, China would open up, liberalize, at some point in time, become like the United States. But of course, it hasn't happened. Indeed, from the American point of view, the opposite has happened, because Xi Jinping has removed term limits, and they say, my God, we put a dictator for life in China. And so there's a genuine moral outrage on the part of Americans when they talk about China and its political system. So it seems like a very simple black and white issue. So let me then bring in the complexity dimension. If a future historian were looking at what is happening today in the dispute between the United States and China on the political front, the question a future historian will ask is, how is it that a republic of 330 million people that is less than 250 years old knows what is good for China better than the Chinese people, who've had a 2,200 years of political history and a population four times the size? And surely the Chinese must know what is good for them. And the Chinese, in the Chinese history and tradition, teaches them one thing, a very powerful lesson. Every time the center in Beijing is weak, the Chinese people suffer. And they suffer massively. Civil war, famine, strife, you name it. But when the center is strong, as it is today, the people benefit. And just for the record, the quality of improvement of life that the Chinese people have enjoyed in the last 30 years has been the best improvement of quality of life that the Chinese have ever had in 3,000 years. So at a time when the Chinese people have experienced the greatest improvement in their quality of life, America is saying, change your government. So who's right? Who's wrong in this dimension? Then you come to the military dimension. Again, it may seem very clear who's right, who's wrong. As you know, the stories in the papers is that China has been aggressive in the South China Sea, and clearly there have been new developments. China has reclaimed land and so on and so forth. And China has drawn a nine-dash line in the South China Sea, and many of these actions are difficult to defend. So China has made mistakes in that area too. But if you talk in terms of who is pushing which side, it's very clear. It's the United States that has naval vessels 12 miles off Chinese shores. China doesn't have naval vessels 12 miles off American shores. And even on the issues that you think are simple and black and white, and I'll give you a concrete example, if you read the media, they'll tell you that one day Xi Jinping met Barack Obama, and offered to Barack Obama, hey, let's abide by the ASEAN conventions on South China Sea. China has no intention of militarizing the islands. And what happened was that a few months later, China militarized the islands. So what happened? The media said Xi Jinping backtracked on his promise. But if you read an article which I wrote in Harper's Magazine, you'll find that an American ambassador, Stapleton Roy, probably one of the best American ambassadors ever to China, said to me, Kishore, when Xi Jinping made that offer to Barack Obama, United States should have accepted it. Instead, we stepped up the naval patrols around those islands, and the Chinese said, okay, you step up naval patrols, I'll militarize. Now, I tell you these stories so that you begin to understand, for every story you hear on the U.S.-China relationship, it's never simply black and white. And on the military dimension, what's remarkable about China, which is perceived to be as an aggressive party, is that China has not fought a major interstate war in 40 years. China hasn't fired one bullet across its borders since 1988, since the naval skirmish with Vietnam. But United States, in 1 year, under the most peaceful American president, Barack Obama, in the last year of Obama's presidency, the United States dropped 26,000 bombs on 7 countries. So who is militarily more aggressive? And to make the story even more interesting, the Chinese would be so happy if the United States continued to drop bombs every year on as many countries as possible, because the more militarily involved the United States is, the better off China is. Right? That's an example of complexity. So let me turn now to the cultural dimension. And this, I can tell you honestly, is a dimension that's very difficult to speak about because it's politically incorrect. Why is it politically incorrect? When we analyze international affairs, we assume that countries who can make decisions on international affairs do so on the basis of rational considerations. Reason is primary, emotions are secondary. But we all know, in our real lives every day, how we react, how we behave, emotions play a role. And it's easier if the emotions are conscious. It's much harder if the emotions are subconscious. And it's even harder if the subconscious emotions have been buried for centuries. And what one subconscious emotion that exists in the Western mind, going back centuries, is a fear somewhere of what is called the yellow peril. It's there. It emerges in Western literature. It emerges in the American Exclusion Act in the late 19th century, and it's alive, it's at play. But you can't see it. It's the invisible elephant in the room. It affects speeches, it affects policies, but it's not conscious. So how do you discuss it? And how do you handle it? That's complexity. And the final dimension, primacy. Here again, you would assume that the United States, as a rational country, would acknowledge the fact that times have changed, that from the year 1 to the year 1820, for 1800, the last 2,000 years, the two largest economies were China and India. So what, going back to the 21st century, is the norm of 1800 years, China and India becoming number one, number two again, and United States should rationally accept it, right? But I can tell you from personal experience, when I had to chair a forum in Davos, like this panel, very distinguished American panel discussing the future of American power. Two American senators, Cocker and Chambliss, New York Congresswoman Nita Lowry, Mike Froman, then Deputy National Security Advisor. First question asked the panel as moderator, what do you see as the future of American power?
Oh, we'll be number one, we'll be number one, we'll be number one, we'll be number one. I said, yes, okay. Then my second question, but, you know, I've seen data that shows, IMF data, that, you know, maybe within 10 years, it's possible that China may have a bigger economy. So what will happen then? And you know what the answers were? We'll be number one, we'll be number one, we'll be number one. But Senator Corker was the smartest. He said, Mr. Chairman, I can do the maths. I can see where you're taking us. I'm not going there. Because it is politically suicidal for any American politician to say publicly on record that United States can become number two someday. And if it's inevitable, and if you cannot speak about it, how do you deal with it? That's another layer of complexity. So I hope I've explained to you how difficult it is going to be to manage this US-China issue. And that's the reason why I'm writing this book at this stage. So if I have made mistakes, or if I'm wrong in my analysis, I hope that you will come through and let me know what I did wrong. But I'm going to conclude with at least some kind of positive note. Otherwise, I fear I may have depressed all of you with my remarks. The question is, can something be done? And my honest view is something can be done. Because at the end of the day, there's 7.5 billion people in the world. 1.4 billion live in China. 330 million live in the United States. That's 1.73 billion. That still leaves over 5.5 billion people in the rest of the world. How do we mobilize these 5.5 billion people to speak up and say, both of you are behaving very dangerously, and therefore, please reconsider. And how do you do that? Now, Hank mentioned this book of mine, Has the West Lost It? As you know, I have a 3M solution inside there. For today, to manage US and China, I have a 1M solution. The 1M solution is multilateral. And if there's one common gene that the European Union has and that ASEAN has, is that we both believe in multilateralism. So if ASEAN and EU can work together and have a joint campaign to say, hey, let's find a multilateral solution to the biggest problem on planet Earth, we may succeed. Thank you very much.